Oklahoma. Matches impedance. It is not a Bellin. If something is funny going on with your antenna, where you're starting to feed RF energy onto the outside of the coax cable going to your antenna, using a quarter-wave matching transformer all by itself, it's not going to change that. Whatever RF energy is flowing down the outside of your transmission line is going to also flow down the outside of the coax cable that is the quarter-wave matching transformer. So that in itself is not a Bellin. Now, there's various ways you can hang a piece of coax cable, the outer shield, at least, of the coax cable, made a quarter wavelength long, as a parallel device near the tip of your transmission line. There's various ways you can use another piece of parallel transmission line as a balancing device. That's called a TEM to TE11 converter. If you choose the right chapter out of the RadLab series on antennas, and there's many places where you can find that. So there's ways you can use a piece of parallel transmission line to force it to give you, at one frequency at a time, a balancing device. But the quarter wave matching transformer all by itself doesn't give you balancing. Here we go, Howie. Could it be 2HWW? Does that make some sense? K2LIW to TechNet?
Repeater, timeout.
Yes.
Brilliant.
What? That antenna should be perfectly. We're assuming that the antenna is resonant, and I'm assuming that there is no current. Obviously, you can't do that. What I said about a parallel, see, that's a dual-band antenna. So, you would need to switch in and out the two lengths of cable because, well, you could probably get it. I mean, 2 meters and 440 are what do you call, you know, they're harmonically related, so maybe you can make it 3/4 to 1/4 wave. I don't know, but I'm assuming that his antenna system doesn't have RF on it. You're not worried about current. You just want to get the impedance of that antenna close to the, so you can match it to the 70 ohm piece of hard line. That's all. So if you wanted to do it that way, I would assume you could use a quarter wave matching transformer.
Now what you said, Howie, has good common sense, but Mother Nature is going to throw another curveball in here for you. He's got right now what he believes is a 1.8 standing wave ratio. And if it was only a resistive component mismatch, in other words, he'd like it to be 50 ohms, and maybe his antenna is resistively 90 ohms. In that particular case, using a quarter-wave matching transformer makes some sense. However, 95% of the time, I'm going to guess, if he had the right kind of an antenna analyzer, and he finds out what is his 1.8-to-1 standing wave ratio, is it a pure resistive mismatch? Almost never. Guaranteed there's a reactive component in there. And if it's got a reactive component in there, the general use of a quarter-wave matching transformer will not correct that. Yes, you can go the next step. There's a way of using a quarter-wave matching transformer to simultaneously match the resistive component and the reactive component. I didn't say it's easy. I'm just saying it's within the laws of physics. It's possible. Almost nobody does that. So, quarter-wave matching transformer, great technique. If your error is only resistive, guarantee the universe that Steve and I live in, Mother Nature is going to throw you another curveball. A big portion of that 1.8 standing wave ratio, I guarantee it's a reactive component. Once he measures it with the right kind of an antenna tuner, what's the next step? Becomes a little bit more obvious. You see where we're going with this one, Steve? KC2MDP, you got a good question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, very good, Dick. Yes, matter of fact, I have antenna analyzer. I have two of them. And, you know, I never even thought to look at that. I just looked at the SWR, said, oh, you know what, it looks good. Let me put it to operation, see if it works. And so far it's working fine. Hopefully when I move it, it'll work fine, and none of this will be necessary. But you know what, I love this hobby. It makes you think, and now I got a bunch of stuff to think about. I really appreciate it, guys. I really do. Thanks.
So, Steve, you've got test equipment you haven't even used yet. You've got all kinds of capabilities. At first, you're going to think The only place to use the antenna analyzer is right at the antenna. Not necessarily. That's one approach. There's nothing magic about you using your antenna analyzer, not on the antenna, but on the transmission line. In other words, the end of the 70-ohm hard line in the shack. Connect the antenna tuner right there. And so don't tell the antenna analyzer you're not connecting it to an antenna. You're connecting it to a transmission line that's going to an antenna. Don't tell your antenna analyzer that. Keep that as a secret. Measure the impedance at that point, resistive component and reactive component, on each of the two bands. Once you've got that data in your pocket on your notepad, the next step as to how to make that all become beautiful becomes a lot more obvious. Once you make those measurements, either later on tonight or next TechNet, you're going to tell us what you measured in the shack with your antenna analyzer, and then we got all kinds of ways of making that Viswell become as perfect as you like. You see where we're going in this one, Steve. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, I do, Dick, and that's why I'm so glad I asked this question before this installation became permanent, as we say.
Okay, good luck with that project, Steve. We've given you some homework, and you're going to come back with some more data. Okay, the next person on our list was NY2H. So go right ahead to NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet. I'm sorry, NY2HF, Dennis. I'm sorry about that. NY2H, Dennis, go right ahead, K2RIW.
All right, well, if you want to go there, there's a lot of things that have been tried that you might find interesting. When I lived in the city, of course, having a one of those little patios that stick out of the side of the building and a metal fence that runs around it, that's a fun thing to load up. Most of my broadcast antennas, they're all DC ground, so they're not even interesting to think about in terms of how they operate. And then, before the World Trade Center went down, there's these beams that actually hold the mast up. And a couple of guys decided, oh, let's see if we can load that up, and they did.
They loaded that up at what frequency, Eric?
In 160 meters.
So you had a 160-meter antenna, which was never designed to be a 160-meter antenna, using the structure that was there, and it's located on the top of a building that's 1,300 feet above Manhattan. I'll bet you that was an interesting set of QSOs. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was a bunch of guys who were crazy like me. It's just a weird group of fellas, a couple of who are no longer with us today, but it was something they tried because they were worried that RF was going to get in places where it wouldn't be nice, so to speak.
Yeah, most of the antennas that are on the top of that roof were VHF, UHF antennas, well-shielded structures with their transmission lines. And you're radiating a signal at 1.8 megacycles with all the filtering and choking and everything else they had. My guess is very little of your 1.8 megacycles ended up in the wrong place and created any grief. Over to you, Eric.
Well, they weren't worried so much about stuff being RF. There's about a large financial company right below them. That's where their UPS and their battery systems were and the generators. A lot of other stuff, whereas I know damn well, like in here, for example, if I key up on UHF, my wonderful, very expensive power regulator decides to listen to the radio and starts varying the line hole. So it's that kind of thing that they were worried about.
Now, considering the altitude and the gain that they were getting, they didn't have to radiate very many watts. And the watts that they're radiating are being spread over a very long length of radiator. As such, the local power flux density in volts per meter is a pretty small number. The chances of that affecting somebody's power supply is pretty slim. I'll bet you guys could have radiated a kilowatt into that without giving anybody any grief.
Yeah, I'll be running these experiments when I'm late at night, you know, like 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, hopefully, nothing would happen. I think they eventually loaded like 500 or 600 watts into the thing. It could be heard. So, it was an interesting experiment. I mean, talk about altitude. One of the gentlemen that I used to work with up there had put together a 100 milliwatt FM radio transmitter, put it into a load, hooked it up to a CD player that was on loop that was playing Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Well, I really shouldn't be saying this on the air because, well, those FCC guys probably no longer around, but he put it up on the shelf, you know, thinking about it burning, and then everybody promptly forgot about the thing. And a couple of weeks later, a few of the fellas from the FCC were up there. They were looking for this illegal FM transmitter that was happening in New York. They were looking for a pirate station that was playing the Dark Side of the Moon forever.
Interesting stuff. And it suddenly went off the air at that time, I'm guessing. When you guys did radiate at 3 o'clock in the morning, 600 watts into this 160-meter, very high antenna. When you talk to people on, when you talk to people on that band, what kind of signal, reports were they getting, Eric?
So 160 meters at that hour is not, well, 160 meters is not super active, but you know, being close in, basically doing 20 over. Really nice and clean, but I know they made a couple of DX contacts that were like in Maryland or somewhere in Pennsylvania. From what I remember, they were able to have a pretty good queue show.
Of the people who are on the top band today, as it's called, the 160 meter ham band, what do they consider DX up for? What kind of range are they getting on a good day? If the ionosphere and the D layer absorption and everything is supporting them correctly. What is the 160 meter ham band like? I've never been there. KE2EJ, KQLIW.
I'm not Paul. Let me see if I have it. Okay. Actually, I don't know if you've ever done AM radio DXing, but when you hear like CKLW and Ontario start coming in, that's time to turn on your radio. 160 meters can do real well when bands open.
Of the hams that are on 160 meters, are they talking mostly North America? Do they get into Europe? Do they get into Asia? What kind of DX do they get if Mother Nature's ionosphere is really supporting them, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, I'm not all that familiar with 160 in terms of when the bands really open. But I've heard Europe and some of other people. I know there's folks that have contact with them. As far as like going over the pole or going over the ocean, I have no idea. The antenna that I was using was a vertical, so I had no sense of directivity.
In my early days of my novice license being on 3750 kilohertz, 80 meter band, CW, at high noon, the D layer absorption was such that to talk to somebody one town away, it was a moderately weak signal when I was radiating 75 watts, or it was 25 watts, I'm not sure. Anyhow, D layer absorption at high noon on those lower HF frequencies is pretty fierce. So real DX on that band probably takes place at midnight or beyond. Is that true, Eric? K2IW?
No, the best DX that I've done on AM meters usually happens around 4 or 5 in the morning. Actually, there's a net that I check into which would start at 6:30. And you can hear, actually, the band would, the noise level would be quiet, and as the hours went on, you get stations that were a little further away, and it would peak, and it would begin to drop out, and the noise level would rise exponentially.
Yeah, once that sun starts beating on the ionosphere, it gives you an awful lot of D-layer absorption. you light up the D layer with a very conductive plasma. Now, quite possibly, Howie has used 150 meters, and tell us a little bit more about what the band is like. WB2HWW, what's 160 meters like, Howie? Q2RIW in the TechNet?
No, I haven't been on 160, except for Fred's house, but I've got to make a comment, is when I was spending time in Greece back in the 90s, I was able to listen to CBS 880 on a short, on an AM broadcast radio. I had a Sony 2010, and when I was in Saloniki at night, I didn't hear it all the time, but I actually was able to hear CBS 880 out of New York, K2RIW, WB2HWW. Hello, Eric.
And from New York City to Greece, that's probably what? 3,500 miles in that order? That's nice, though. That's down the road a piece. Let's see what else we're going to discuss on this particular subject. So, your major motivation is the extra gain, and the capacitors are primarily an impedance matching device and maybe a broadbanding device if it's put in the right location. There are various people who have experimented with putting a whole bunch of distributed capacitors along the length of a wire in order to get various electrical characteristics. It's a heroic approach. I'm not sure that they've ever seen huge increases in performance. There are various people who think they're going to get a whole lot of extra gain out of that. There, I'm very skeptical. Let me drop. Because gain comes from real estate. In other words, if simplistically you look at the two ends of your very long wire, and assuming there's an omnidirectional radiator at the far end and the near end, and now those two signals coming out of there are coherent, they're coming from the exact same piece of wire, so they're on the same frequency on some fixed phase, and now you go out in space and you figure out that the signal coming from the right-hand end, the signal coming from the left-hand end, at this particular point in space, there's two places, those two signals are in phase. Move a little bit in azimuth out there on that ring a mile away, and you'll find a place where those two signals are out of phase. That's your first null. So, real gain, real directivity is coming from an interferometry pattern. The interferometry pattern is coming from some number of wavelengths of spacing between the extremes of the radiator. So, you're not going to get super directivity out of a short piece of wire. A short piece of wire with the right kind of impedance matching device, you can make any short piece of wire radiate on any frequency you like. But if that piece of wire is a tenth of a wavelength long, the signal coming out of there is going to be very close to omnidirectional because it doesn't have the resources to do anything else. Let me drop it.
You know, the capacity changes the phase of what's passing through.
The capacitor changes the phase. That changes the phase angle of the two tips of the antenna, so to speak, as an interferometer. That means you steer the beam to a slightly different point in space. But the beam width you're going to get out there is a function of how many wavelengths are there from the far end versus the near end. It's interferometry at a microscopic scale, you know, 1 inch at a time along the wire. I can break it up into a whole bunch of isotropic radiators and then add them all up at some point in space. So real directivity comes from wavelengths of spacing between the extremes of the antenna acting as an interferometer. That's where the antenna pattern comes from. There are various people who think that some kind of magic inside of the antenna is going to give you directivity, that you can make an antenna that's a quarter wavelength total length in its major dimension, and you're going to get a whole lot of directivity out of that by some magic, by what you do inside of that volume. Absolutely not. That can't give you directivity. KE2EJ, K2RIW, a lot of people fall into that trap.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, that was the interesting thing. That's why the hours were spent in using the modeling program. Based upon the position of the capacitors, not only did it change the pattern, I mean, it changed the impedance of the whole system, and also it changed the Q. And really the goal here was really to try and make this a band to be used without a tuner. And that was really the driving force in the beginning, and there was the concept of directivity. as we move the capacitors along the length of the line, the way that the pattern changes is quite dramatic.
Okay, let's get specific now, Eric. If you put no capacitor in your double ZEP antenna, what do you believe was the natural Q of that antenna? And what was the beamless of the main lobe? How many degrees of beamless was the main lobe? Now, when you put in the capacitors, did the Q go down by 2 to 1? I'm skeptical. And although the pattern, you may have skewed the pattern a little bit, the main lobe, I'm having trouble believing the main lobe suddenly went from 80 degrees wide down to 50 degrees wide, if you know what I mean. So, what happened to the Q? What happened to the beam width of the main lobe? Skewing the main lobe, I'm going to give you that. But changing the main lobe beam width in degrees, I'm having trouble believing you made much of a change on that. KE2EJ, KQIW.
I didn't actually try the classical ZEP, but the classical ZEP actually works out when you model it, and also when you look at it in the book. It looks like a figure eight, and it has, say, if you're looking straight down at it, it's got ears on both sides. So, and I think the cue of that is, I'm trying to remember what we came up with in the model. I think it was fairly reasonable. I think it was in the order of like 10 or 7 or something like that. When we went with the capacitors, the Q actually got lower. And the ears, so to speak, that you see in the classical diminished. As far as like the figure eight pattern itself, if you were to compare one to the other, they're pretty much close to being exactly the same.
Okay, now what you're saying makes a lot of sense, Eric. So if the natural Q is 10, and you put the capacitor in just the right spot, and the apparent Q across your frequency range of interest went to 7, I'd sort of agree with that. You told me that the main lobe didn't move very much. If you plotted the main lobe before adding the capacitor and after adding the capacitor, the main lobe looked almost the same. I'm going to believe that, because it's the same amount of real estate, tip to tip, if you know what I mean. Now, what you're calling the ears are side lobes of an antenna pattern. The total amount of energy in those side lobes is fairly minor. So the fact that those side lobes started off, let me pick a number, 10 dB down and 15 degrees of beam width, and the fact that they suddenly disappeared doesn't mean that that's the mechanism by which you're picking up this extra 3 dB of gain, so to speak. The total energy in those side lobes is relatively minor compared to that main lobe, Eric. So the main reason you're putting the capacitors there really is ideal tuning characteristics, so you didn't need an antenna tuner. That's my guess. KE2EJ, KQIW.
KQIW, KE2EJ. Well, we could notice, and the thing that we were comparing things to on the air, which is not really, it's sort of like comparing apples and oranges, is that it's a very tightly tuned dipole right at the AM frequency. And being able to compare between that, both antennas being oriented in the same direction, was that a statement with pretty much on axis with the antenna pretty much worked out the same. But on the dipole, you could hear someone that was off axis with the antenna by, say, 40 or 50 degrees, and the amount of signal coming out of the double intercept was a lot less because it wasn't the right direction.
And maybe one of the nulls of the double-ended zebra was aimed in that direction that you're not hearing. Is that possible, Eric?
We considered that it might be several nulls in the antenna, because you can only go by whatever your modeling is and kind of visualize it, because getting empirical data is going to be an issue. So what we kind of did was, over a period of time, noting where stations were and plotting them out on a map, and noting the supposed pattern that the antenna is supposed to create, you could see where the main lobe was and where these stations were, and he made a comparison between the traditional dipole and the double end is up, and it showed a little more directivity than the standard dipole did.
This is an interesting set of experiments you're doing, Eric, both modeling and really building the antennas in various forms. From where you stand right now, what do you believe is going to be your next step on this particular experiment? KE2EJ, KE2RIW?
Well, right now, we've already moved on to another subject, which I'll hit you with in a second. It's just going to be, it's being used, so, you know, he's an avid operator. His transmitter is a Collins AM transmitter that is in a broadcast station that we both modified and moved it to 160. And then another set of coils for 80. So, it gives you a little sense of who this guy is.
Let me do a quick break and see if we can pick up Dennis and then come back to your second subject, Eric. NY2HF, K2RIW, are you still with us, Dennis? Maybe Dennis got called away. Okay. You're number one on the runway again, Eric. Go right ahead with your next subject. K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Now, here's another one that we were thinking about. I'm started looking into it, and I've come up with this cockamamie idea. Basically, we're talking about magnetic loop antennas, but for a chest now. And I'm thinking about feeding it with a gamma mat, and I haven't quite yet come up with the right way to calculate what the gamma mat should be. I know how to do it for a Yagi, but this is a little bit of a different concept, and frequency is one heck of a lot lower.
I'm going to guess that your loop is going to be parallel to the ground. Maybe its circumference is going to be in the vicinity of a wavelength, and you're going to be feeding it with a gamma as opposed to another loop. Quite often people will feed the outer loop with a small inner loop, and the inner loop has tuning controls to it. Now, depending on how you make your gamma, and you actually go out there and adjust the length of the gamma and the tuning series capacitor, finding the right tuning will happen pretty fast. But you want to model it ahead of time, is what I think you're doing, as opposed to actually doing it as an empirical experiment. Some of my guesses are close, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW. And by the way, how many feet above the ground and what band?
Spot on. Actually, we're thinking about doing it both as parallel to the ground and perpendicular to the ground. But that's a whole other story. You get to the first things to work first. This could probably be a foot or 2 foot above the ground in terms of height. It can go higher, but that's where we're starting. It's going to be a wavelength that's folded a number of times, so that's why it's a magnetic loop. I think I can physically... yeah, you're right. I want to model it first. I want to get into the ballpark. You know, as smart and as stupid as modeling programs can be, they get you a good starting point.
The fact that this antenna is only going to be a couple of feet above the ground tells me that 90% of your radiated energy is going to be coupled very tightly into that volumetric roughy material called Mother Earth. So you're going to get you're going to be heating up the worms with an awful lot of your Earth energy. Have you considered the possibility of making a poor man's equivalent of a DDRR, directional discontinuity ring radiator? There's a version of the DDRR where the ring that does the radiating is two rings, one above the other. And the two rings, if you take a cross-section of the ring, it looks like a piece of open-wire transmission line where one wire is high and one wire is low, but you're feeding them differentially. So it has its own built-in ground plane, so to speak, so that now a high percentage of the energy is not directly coupled into the Earth. Have you considered that as another modification here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2
K2RW, K2J, what's that type of antenna called again?
This is a subset of what's called DDRR, Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator, DDRR. And one of the subsets of that is it really is two rings, one above the other. Because they're making an amount of wire, the fact that you're building two rings is a minor detail as far as cost of materials are concerned. But you feed the upper wire versus the lower wire differentially, so that in cross-section, the antenna looks like open wire line, but the open wire line is made into a great big loop, and one wire is higher than the other. You have your own built-in kind of an RF shield to the earth, so not as much of the energy goes straight down into the earth, if you know what I mean. You build one simple ring a couple feet above the ground, a lot of your energy is directly coupled into that volumetric lossy material called earth. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2J. It took a while for that to ring bells in my head. And essentially, on the back of my car in the 70s, I had what looked like two-meter halos, but it was differentially fed. So, I know what you're talking about. That's an idea. And the only reason for it being 2 or 3 feet off the ground is to build it. After that, then we would raise it. But we're also thinking about doing it in a vertical mode and rotating it, but that comes later.
Now, your ring radiator, you're thinking of feeding it in the gamma way, which is a good way to feed it. However, one of the things that Mel did, KE2EJ, was to, all of a sudden I forget his call, I haven't heard from him in a long time, K2YEW. He fed his one wavelength loop, which I think was mounted 80 feet above the ground, he fed it with open wire line. So he took his loop, opened it at one particular spot, and fed it with open wire line. His open wire line came down to the shack to a kind of broadband differential antenna tuner. Because of the controls he had in his antenna tuner, he could feed the open wire line going to the loop in a thoroughly differential manner. Nothing fancy about that. Then he could decide to make the right-hand wire hot compared to the left-hand wire. And he could slowly slide from fully differential to fully common mode. As he fed the open wire line to the loop antenna in the common mode way, he had an entirely different antenna pattern.
K2UPS.
Change by 90 degrees.
Rich recognized. As he slowly slid from fully differential to fully common mode, and he was really shifting 180 degrees, so to speak. Yeah. The two wires are being fed 180 degrees out of phase, and he's slowly shifting the way he's feeding them, how much power he feeds into each one, and the phase angle between the two, but he had the ability to go from 180 degrees to 0 degrees of difference between the two wires. The two wires are now being fed common mode with reference to Earth. As he did that, his one wavelength loop changed in polarization, changed in radiation pattern. He was electronically steering the antenna. So you've got all kinds of other sideline benefits out of feeding this with open wire line instead of feeding it with coax into a gamma match. I think you should consider that as a possibility. Let's see what Rich has got to say on all of the above. K2UPS. I bet you've seen some loop antennas in your travels, Rich. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, thank you, Dick. And Eric, I might have some information for you on the gamma match metal loop. I've done a lot of research into it, and I had just checked the page. They talk about the gamma match being the length of the gamma match being 1/10 of the perimeter of the loop, and spacing away from the loop to be 1/200. Was a 2000. I got to double check that a lambda of the frequency that you're on. I don't know if that helps you as a starting point or not. K2UPS.
Thank you, Rich. I am familiar with it. So dealing with it at 144 or at 50 megahertz is easy. Going down into lower frequencies and a little bit of power is with Mike Vicenza. But Dick, what you just mentioned, by the way, Hal, if you're listening, hello to you. I'm just making a tuner that's going to move the phase. I'm now thinking of a roller inductor. I don't know exactly how, I have to think about that. How would I go from truly double-ended differential to common mode in a nice, smooth way? I could do it with switches and calculate the phase angle for each particular amount of heading towards common mode or heading towards differential. But there's something about taking that output, and it's not clear in my mind yet, but it'll come. But that's a very interesting idea, and we could do a bunch of interesting things with it beyond using just a single loop like that. P2RWK to again.
I'm not quite sure how Mel did it, but the way we discussed it, I think one of the things he considered, maybe it's the way he carried it out, is he built a pair of Pi networks in the same box. So the transmitter went into a T connector, which fed two separate Pi tuning arrangements. The output of each Pi fed one of the two wires of the twin lead going out of this thing, the open wire line. As such, when he now adjusts the controls on the two separate Pi antenna tuning networks, he could easily change the phase of each wire with reference to ground. The box, of course, was grounded. And so he could make one side leading and the other side lagging and end up with plus 90 degrees, minus 90 degrees. So you're now feeding them 180 degrees apart, fully differential. And by taking these individual antenna tuners, and by adjusting them to be in resonance or out of resonance, he had the ability to adjust what fraction of the power went into the right-hand wire versus the left-hand wire. And he could also, by way of adjusting the two Pi networks, he could literally slide from fully differential to fully common mode, and whether or not the right-hand wire is hotter than the left-hand wire. So when you take all of the possibilities of what fraction of the power goes into each wire, and what's the phase angle of the difference between the two wires, you now have all kinds of electronic tuning of what you radiate. And there were times when, he was either listening or talking to somebody in Europe, and a particular station would sound really nice and loud in the differential mode, and the guy would be almost not there in the common mode today, and tomorrow it was the opposite. On top of that, there were times he found that when he listened in one mode and transmitted in the other mode, he had the best communication with the guy in Europe. So he really had polarimetry control to some degree, antenna pattern control to some degree, and so that the non-reciprocity you get from Faraday rotation of the ionosphere, to some degree with this crazy network, he could adapt to that. So open wire feeding of a loop with that kind of a network in the shack gives you a lot of extra knobs to twiddle and a lot of extra experiments on what you radiate in pattern and polarization. KE2EJ, K2RIW. K2RIW, K2EJ. Okay. Now I've got some new ideas. It's as though he had two tuners and he was adjusting them, which actually can bring you into some bad places. As far as like the load on the transmitter is concerned. But now I'm thinking about it. If I had two Pi networks hooked up to two sets of inputs on a microcontroller and taking in data from VHC and even audio at this point, what we would do is build a little noise detector and look for minimum noise and sort of like make it an automatic antenna tuner, in a sense. That'd be an interesting project to do with, like, an Arduino or something of that nature. Yeah, when the output of your transmitter goes into a T-connector, and the two T-connector feeds two separate antenna tuners that feed independently the two wires of your open wire line, yes, there are a couple of forbidden zones in the way you tune the two. However, If the common line to the common load to the common transmission line to the transmitter has a standing wave ratio bridge, or just a reflected power meter on it, a bird looking at the reverse power, you could always find ways of adjusting the knobs to stay away from the forbidden regions. You'll eventually make yourself a chart saying, don't go into this particular region, if you know what I mean. So that's nowhere near as difficult as you think. But once you've got complete adaptability of differential phase, differential power, you now have a lot more ways of taking this simple-looking antenna, a simple piece of one-wavelength wire suspended in the air, and by all the possible ways you can feed it, you can adjust to some degree pattern and polarization. And he had a lot of fun with that thing. There was quite a number of surprises he was coming up with that. And it was unfortunate that he became sick just as he was getting pretty heavy into finding out all the things that could do. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Yeah, I think I'm changing. I have a lot of talking to do with my friend. I'm thinking about changing this whole project now. I do like to do things with microcontrollers, and the forbidden zones would be very easy to program and say, you're never going to go there. And actually, if I'm really smart about it, I can take feedback in terms of antenna voltage and antenna current from both sides. So, that's an interesting project. Maybe it'll happen. What the heck? Summer's coming, it's warm, you can do antenna stuff. I'd have to put some antennas up at my house, but we'll see. All right, K2RIW, thank you for your input. Very useful. K2J.
Yeah, once you've got a pair of Pi antenna tuners running in parallel like that, by way of knocking one out of resonance, you can make sure that very little power goes down that wire, and so on. And so, when you can operate them differentially, like we're describing, you can always make the impedance match back to the transmitter perfect, and you've now got complete freedom as to what percentage of power and at what phase angle goes into each one of the wires of the open wire line that's feeding the loop antenna. That gives you a lot of capability. When it comes to the two wires being fed differentially, which is one extreme, equal power, and fully common mode, equal power, if you try to explain that to a person, it's not easy. To a person who's not familiar with phase and power and amplitude, one way you can do it is the index finger on your right hand and index finger on your left hand, you operate the hands in a differential manner. In other words, at one instant of time, you're raising the right hand and you're lowering the left hand. And in the next half cycle, you reverse. The next half cycle, you reverse that. So now that's demonstrating the full differential mode. But now if you raise and lower both hands simultaneously, that's the fully common mode. Up and down represents instantaneous voltage you're putting on the wire. Up is positive voltage, down on your index finger is a negative voltage. So your right hand is going up and down, your left hand is going up and down, and whether you do it differentially or common mode makes it a little bit clearer to a person as to what kind of a signal you're launching into that open wire line. And the antenna, the loop antenna itself has got various ways of behaving. By the way, the loop antenna has a different impedance when it's fed in the common mode versus the differential mode. But because you've got two independent antenna tuners and a properly designed Pi network can go from very high impedances to very low impedances, you have enough adaptability to adjust for all of that. You see the principle here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Yeah, well, most people don't realize when they use a piece of Ethernet cable, they're using stuff that's in a differential mode. For your HDMI cable, your TV set. I'm now thinking about push-pull amplifier where each amplifier is 180 degrees, apart from one another, using that as a source of getting differential output and being able to change the phase on each output line independently. Again, you know, two antenna tuners will do the trick, but I think two pies and the knobs associated with it will do the trick, and you can go the full 360 degrees on each one.
Yes, you can. And now the equivalent of your antenna tuner is really the pi tank network of each of the two transmitters. So there's lots of ways of doing this, but that loop itself has all kinds of capabilities that an awful lot of people don't know about. Good luck with that project. See now, let me for a minute say, did anybody within the sound of my voice go to the Near East Astronomy Forum at Rockland Community College this weekend? If so, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, that's from what I hear, it's an awfully good show. It's both a solar observatory, great big conference held out into the front lawn of the building. A whole lot of people set up their solar telescopes, looking at various kinds of wavelengths of solar energy with a telescope, both white light and hydrogen alpha and so on, as well as something like 150 vendors of telescope and microscope and eyepieces and so on, laser pointers, something like 150 vendors inside the building, and a whole bunch of lectures done by people from NASA as well as other big observatories. Maybe it's time now we go over to the space portion. So I've already forgotten the satellite that's going around Jupiter, Juno I think it's called, either they already have or they're very close to the point of planning on dumping Juno, diving it into Jupiter itself at the end of mission in order to make sure it doesn't contaminate any of the other experiments that are going to take place downrange. So bring us up to speed on that, Paul. WS2N with the space report number 246. K2RIW
in a second, Ed.
You've got it, Paul.
This is WS2N, and good evening, Dick, and everybody else. The astronomy forum, I'd like to see that, you know, it's always in that location, I think. I'd like to see, why don't they go to Stony Brook? That would be great. I mean, you know, it's a big campus. All kinds of, you know, you can Brookhaven Lab here, and you know, I think it would be good. But, one day maybe they'll do that. I know they have, you said you've gone there for the first Friday of every month during the school year. They have a program there. Well, let's make it a big one. Bring that whole thing. That was up in upstate, bringing it, Rockland County, I think Craig said, bringing it to Long Island. Okay, you asked about Juno. Yeah, well, I think we're confusing mixing up the two spacecraft, Cassini and Juno. Let me try them. Juno was the one that just went into orbit July 4th of last year, 2016. And that was supposed to go into a very short orbit. It was out at a 53-day orbit, and they wanted to make it a 14-day orbit, so every 14 days they would get a lot of science information. And it's in a polar orbit, you know, going over the north and coming out by the South Pole, but it's very elongated, so it goes out millions of miles and then comes back every 53 days. What happened was they had a problem with the check valve on a propulsion rocket, the one that put them into this orbit to begin with. You know, they were coming flying by at 100,000 plus miles an hour, and this rocket turned on, slowed them down, it worked perfectly. But they noticed the check valve didn't close quick enough. So they're thinking if they do this again and bring it into a 14-day orbit, it might not work. So rather than gamble on losing all that science, they feel they still get the same amount of science. They'll just have to wait 53 days before they do a close approach instead of 14 days. Our original plan was 33 orbits. So, you know, they were hoping for, you know, three years or so. Now that's going to be extended to quite a bit, you know, what, three or four times the amount that was originally planned. So that's Juno. And then, yeah, in the long run, after this 4 or 5 year years go by, they plan on deorbiting Juno and letting it crash into the atmosphere of Jupiter, burn up, become part of Jupiter. And they don't want it to accidentally hit a moon. What would happen would be, oh, years from now, you'd go back with a spacecraft, land on a moon, look for microbes or something, and they'll be saying, oh, no, those microbes, they didn't start at Jupiter, they started on Earth, and they hitched a ride on Juno. So rather than have that possibility, as remote as it is, they'll deorbit it into a planet. They did the same thing with Galileo. Galileo was for many years orbiting Jupiter, looking at all the moons very close up. That mission, and when that ended, they burnt that up into the atmosphere as well. Now, the mission that's going to be burnt up in September, drop it, is the one orbiting Saturn, Cassini. And this September, it will burn up into the atmosphere. You know, they're starting this slow approach now to dive in through the ring very closely to the, you know, to the ring. They're going to roll the dice and hope they don't hit anything. And they're going to point the antenna in the direction of travel, using it as a shield as they go in. And then once in a while, turn it back toward Earth to get reception of the pictures and information that Cassini will be picking up. So, yeah, that's going to happen this September. It's running out of fuel, and again, they don't want it to accidentally hit it into a moon of Saturn. So that's going to happen in September. It was put into orbit in 2004. It took, what, 5 or 6 years for it to get there. It was launched on a space shuttle in the cargo bay. Went out to Saturn, went into its orbit in 2004. So it's been giving science to us since then, roughly 13 years or so straight. So it's really done its mission. Let me drop it. I think that's pretty much it about that. I could cover a couple of the topics if you want, Dick. K2RI, WWSY.
Go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, okay. You have a crew coming back from the International Space Station coming up on the, was it the 20th? So, next week or so. Probably the 20th daytime, standard time. I'll have to look. They usually cover that live, come back on the Soyuz spacecraft and land in Kazakhstan. That'll be bringing back Shane Kimbrough and two Russians. And back on there, one parachute. A lot of people always wonder, why don't they have three parachutes? You know, like we have on the Orion, and what you're going to have on Dragon and the Starliner when that gets going. But they do have a spare parachute. You know, you always have, they show one parachute on the Soyuz. But in case that doesn't work, there was another spare that would come out, backup parachute. Not as big, but it would have a little rough landing. So we're looking forward to that crew coming back. That'll leave three on board. And one of those people are Peggy Whitson, an American. We drop it. And the day before they leave, couple of days before they leave. She becomes commander. Shane Kimbrough was commander. Now she'll take over. That'll be the first time a woman will command the ISS for the second time. She's not a before. She's been up there quite a bit. Of, you know, three different times. She's broken a record for women doing EVAs. She's up to 8. So, something. You do have another launch coming up of the Cygnus, Soyuz. That'll be going up later on this month too. And that's with Jack Fisher and one Russian, just two people. Usually three, but just two this time. And the reason for that is the Russians are cutting back on their program a little bit. It's getting a little too costly. They're not getting as much science from the space station that they used to. So to make up for that, Peggy Whitson, who's supposed to come back in another month or so, will be staying as commander on the space station for at least another 3 months after that. So when she comes back, she's going to come back with these two guys that are going up now, and then they'll have three coming back. And that's the way it'll work for a while. I think they do have a plan on sending up three more. They're not going to have a blank space. They're going to have three seats filled on future missions. Originally, that was going to be two going up for the next couple of years, but things have changed. NASA's managed to acquire more seats. So, that's the story on the International Space Station. Cygnus is going up on the 19th of April. Cygnus is a cargo vehicle, and that's been delayed. It was supposed to go up a couple of weeks ago because of hydraulic problems. Well, originally on Launch Complex 41, leading up to the rocket, but now they found hydraulic leaks in the engine compartments of the Atlas V rocket, so that was delayed. But that'll be going up on the 19th. That's bringing about 7,000 or more pounds of stuff to the space station. Drop it. So, there's more things to cover. I just wanted to mention only one more thing, and you know, if you want more topics, we can do it. But we talk about all these different rockets that are being built. NASA's got the SLS, the Space Launch System, which is going to be larger than the Saturn V rocket that took people to the moon. They're building that. That should go, you know, do its maiden flight in about a year or so. And then you have other companies like SpaceX. They're building their Falcon 9s on a regular basis, flying them into space. They have a future plan for a big monster rocket called the Interplanetary Transport System. They're building another monster rocket. Blue Origin has one called the New Glenn, which is almost as big as the Saturn V, a little shorter than that, but that's being built down in Florida. That should go up in around 2020. But, you know, it seems like every month I see another story about another company doing something. Orbital ATK, they're the ones that launch rockets out of Virginia. They launched the Antares rocket with the Cygnus spacecraft on board, same one that's going up on the Atlas rocket. That's interchangeable. They can either go up on Antares or they can go up on the Atlas of Dropping. This is WS2N. The same company, Orbital ATK, now got an approval to build their own large rocket. Not quite as big as the Saturn V, but pretty darn powerful. And they're going to call that for now the NGL, or Next Generation Launch System. And instead of all these, you know, these standard rockets are usually some kind of liquid fuel rocket. There is either kerosene or the methane or, you know, liquid hydrogen or something like that. This is going to be an all-solid booster system, the whole rocket, except for the third stage, first two stages are going to be solid booster and large rocket, wherever they can jump.